You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, January 1st, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. Happy New Year! We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building. The fashionable dollar lunch district of New York City. They're still picking up the litter from New Year's Eve here just outside of Times Square. Oh my gosh. Where are my pants? Should old acquaintance. I don't know the rest of the song. Ladies and gentlemen, it is the final day of my vacation. But we still have some best of 2012 to give you. And on the program today, Corey Robin on his book, The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin. Richard Wolff, professor of economics emeritus, University of Massachusetts at Amherst, on When Capitalism Fails. Enjoy these two interviews and our sprinkling of some of the best of libertarian phone calls, monologue, whatever we have in store for you today. Tomorrow we'll be back live. I'm going to be so rusty. I don't even know what. I have no idea what we're going to be doing. But enjoy this. I hope you had a great New Year's. I hope you have a good New Year's going forward, ladies and gentlemen. To you and your loved ones, I want to thank you again for all the support that you have given this show over the past couple of years. Obviously, it goes without saying, I couldn't do it without you, literally. I mean, I could talk alone in a room, and I would, but I couldn't do it professionally without your support. So I really appreciate that. So not only am I thanking you for listening, but I'm also thanking you, particularly you members, obviously, who support this program so generously, keep it afloat. And I really do appreciate that. I count that as one of the things I am most thankful for, you know, after, of course, the health of my family. And things like, you know, Survivor. I get to watch that on Thursday nights. I don't know. I get to try and keep my expectations low. That's what I try and do. All right, folks, enjoy these two interviews. We will be back live tomorrow.
And Happy New Year.
Didn't I say Happy New Year?
Well, again, Happy New Year.
All right. Well, Matt apparently wanted to wish you a Happy New Year, too.
I'm going to tell all you fascists, you may be surprised. People all over this world are getting organized to bound to lose. You fascists are bound to lose. Race hatred cannot stop us, this one. You're about to lose, you fascist, about to lose.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Brooklyn College CUNY Graduate Center teacher and the author of The Reactionary Mind, Conservatism from Edmund Burke to Sarah Palin. You can also check out his blog. It's CoreyRobin.com. Okay, great. And welcome to the show. Thanks again for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
I'm really enjoying your book. I've been dancing around in it because that's the way I read now, because my six-year-old daughter doesn't allow me to maintain a single thought for any period of time. But it's a fascinating book. And I want to start, with the notion that, in the book you break down some of the sort of the popular misconceptions about conservatism. One specifically that conservatism is sentimental and wants to return to an older time and is about tradition. But in fact, you point out that it really is only sentimental for a certain dynamic, and that in fact it's fairly radical in attempting to recreate this dynamic.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, conservatism always begins in reaction to a movement, a democratic movement from the left that is trying to basically break hierarchical bonds between subordinates and superiors. Abolition, the French Revolution, the labor movement, the women's movement, the civil rights movement, all the great social movements of the left provoke a reaction on the right. And what's interesting about that reaction from the right is that rather than just defend the established order, what conservatives oftentimes do is they become very scorching critics of the established order. They say that the old elites have kind of gotten us into this situation because they were lazy, they were decadent, they were too materialistic. And so what they insist on is that those elites need to be kind of, you need to clean house, and you need to recreate the old regime. And so they're not defending what was. What they really are doing is recreating or creating something that never was in the first place, and oftentimes with the most sort of radical rhetoric and radical instruments.
And that that thing that they're recreating ultimately is sort of this hierarchical, a hierarchical dynamic where it is – where the subject of that dynamic is always people who are looking to be emancipated, either sort of socially or economically.
That's correct. Women, slaves, African Americans, post-slavery workers, and the second part of what's interesting is that in trying to beat back these movements, not only do they recreate the old order and the old regime, but they also are smart enough and far-seeing enough to understand that you have to find a way of recreating the old order in such a way that the lower orders, women, blacks, can find a place for themselves, a new place for themselves. So it's not just simply recreating the old hierarchies. It's trying to find a way, it's trying to find a way that the poor people can imagine themselves to be part of the ruling class. So in the defense of slavery, you see the slaveholders being very cognizant that they can't just defend plantations. They have to find a way to make sure that all white men understand themselves to be either slaveholders or slaveholders in the making. So they broaden the definition of the ruling class, and you see this over and over and over again up until, you know, the Nixon silent majority, you know, trying to include white ethnics to be part of a kind of new ruling class that would exclude African Americans and so forth.
You know, when I was reading that part of your book, there were two things that came to mind. One was Welcome to the Dollhouse, this Todd Solondz movie where and I don't know if you saw it, but the lead is a 12-year-old girl. Maybe she's a little bit older, I'm not sure. And she would get picked on at school, but she would come home and then kick her daughter, essentially. And that's
right.
The dynamic, right? I mean, they're saying to that character, if you will, that, okay, you're not necessarily the leader or the boss, but you can be a boss.
You know, it's funny that you bring up that analogy. John Adams wrote a very important book called The Discourses on Davila. And in there, he talks about this exactly this dynamic, and he says, you know, the beggar on the street will never get rid of his dog, even if it would save his life, you know, because he could buy food or whatever. And when asked why, he'll say, well, who else would I have around that I basically can kick? Me feel like I'm the top dog around here. So that's exactly right. That's a very important part of the dynamic, is you don't level the playing field. You don't elevate people on the bottom, but what you do is you give those people who are near the bottom some power over people who are even closer to the bottom. You create these ever finer gradations on the bottom so that even if you're, you know, not a wealthy elite, you still can play the part of a little lord. And it's real. It's not just symbolic power. It's actual real power.
You know, there was a, and I imagine you saw this as well, but recently there was a study that showed that the issue, when it comes to taxes, the issue is not that the reason why, we can talk more. I want to talk about this notion, because your notion sort of refutes the what's the matter with Kansas notion, but the idea that people don't want to pay taxes because they presume someday they will also be millionaires, but it's that they are concerned that their tax money is going to people who are poorer than them, and it may change the dynamic between those poor people and themselves.
Yeah, exactly. I think economists call this the last place aversion, that basically people are willing to put up with a tremendous amount of inequality, tremendous amount of superiority domination over them, so long as they can be assured that they're not the last person on the bottom, that that's the real thing that drives everything. Now, mine is, I mean, I want to be careful because I'm not trying to make a psychological argument about what lies at conservatism. It's much more about the intellectual and ideological arguments, the philosophical arguments. But it does dovetail with some of the sort of data that more empirically oriented social scientists have found.
And so this notion that that conservatives are tricking their followers into buying into an ideology that sort of subjugates them is in fact almost got it backwards.
Right. I think that conservatives are extraordinarily clear with their base about what they're all about, and I think their base, for the most part, understands what they are all about. I mean, just look at something like the backlash against the civil rights movement. That was one of, most historians believe, you know, conservatism as a modern movement begins in the 30s in reaction to the New Deal, but it's not until the 60s and the 70s that it really becomes a kind of mass majority movement, and there's a lot of reasons for that, but one of them is the civil rights movement. And when conservatives start sort of recasting white supremacy as one of the kind of linchpins of what they're all about, that's not tricking anybody. They're saying that there is a population beneath you, African Americans, and that you stand above them. And people don't want to lose that kind of status and privilege and power. And so, again, I just don't see the subterfuge that's going on there. I mean, sometimes the language will try to massage what that, you know, that vision and sort of soften it slightly. But, you know, read Lee Atwater, read all these guys who designed this strategy. It's all very out there and, you know, and in the open.
And it also explains why you can have sort of the dovetail of sort of the, there's a dovetailing of the sort of the fundamentalist strain of republicanism, fundamentalist religious strain, because it also says that, you know, at the very least, we're going to make sure that you, and by you I mean a white male, you'll still be the head of the household.
Exactly. And it's not just the head of the household. I mean, that's a critical part. Again, the backlash against the women's movement was a huge boon for the Christian right, and ultimately the victory of Ronald Reagan. But remember, there's another component to this which relates to race, which I talk about in my book. Richard Viguerie, who was really one of the kind of leading architects of the Christian right and the new right, He said the single biggest thing that brought us recruits to the Christian right was the defense of what were called segregation academies in the old, in the New South. In other words, after the segregation orders came in, lots of white people pulled their children out of public schools and put them in what, you know, were kind of religious schools. But they, the real purpose of them was that they were segregated, and they got a tax break for doing it because it was a religious school. The Nixon administration, of all people, of all places, tried to end the tax break, and that just sent, you know, just droves of Christian activists into the hands of the Christian right. And so it's the defense of the household, as you say, but it's also a defense of white supremacy, historically at least. It's obviously changed quite a bit since then, but that was one of the key factors.
And so ultimately, when we look at to understand at least the intellectual underpinnings of conservatism, and this gets sort of filtered out and plays on sort of some emotional tendencies, and I appreciate that you don't, that you're not as interested, at least in the context of this book, in the sort of the psychological and the emotional responses, but it ultimately is just fundamentally anti-egalitarian, and not just in an economic sense, but in any sense of the word.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's exactly right. It's what I say. It's against the sort of the quality of power, really, because I think power is a much more encompassing term than just economic resources. You know, for instance, during the New Deal, you know, the real thing that the business class fought more than anything else was not Social Security and unemployment compensation and things like that, although they did fight that. But the real thing was the unionization of the workforce, because that was about real personal control over the workplace. And that's really the key of my argument, is that it's these personal relationships of power that conservatives try to seek to defend, and on exactly the grounds that you're saying, that it's that they essentially believe that equality means the end of greatness and excellence and everything that's good in this world, and that inequality is key to making the world a better place, basically.
And I mean, how does that get translated down to the average Joe? I mean, in terms of like that concept of greatness, does it basically just say, well, you can still be great, we're just gonna make sure, you know, you just got to look at it within the context of your limited playing field?
I think it's a couple of ways. One is just that, what you just said, you know, that you are you partake of a version of greatness if you are, you know, a kind of low-level frontline supervisor in a factory, or if you're a father in your household, that you are in some way, shape, or form, you know, just a smaller version of an aristocrat or a king. So that's one very important stream. I think there's another, though, which is a little bit harder to get your hands on, but I think you see it in someone like Sarah Palin, who's no longer in the news, which is that the conservative has this idea that there's a kind of an extraordinary capacity for greatness out there in the population somewhere, and that when it emerges, it's kind of a miracle. And the historical analogy, I would say, is that there's been long been an obsession on the French conservative right, going back to the 19th century, with Joan of Arc, this peasant girl who appears out of nowhere to save France, has, you know, no leadership skills as far as we can see before she comes on the scene. She has no experience. She has no education. She's just, you know, a kind of nothing who becomes a something, and it's almost like a miracle of God. And I think that's the other thing that conservatism, there's a real romanticism or romance of the extraordinary, which say someone like Sarah Palin, who kind of barely made it through college, who was a kind of completely lackluster, desultory governor, who showed very little awareness about international affairs, that somehow or another she was just going to kind of emerge on the scene, selected by, you know, this heroic man, John McCain, and that she was going to be able to kind of govern the most powerful country in the world with no experience. And I think there's an awful lot of that kind of romance. And I think there's a paradigm for conservatives there that, you know, that there's a diamond in the rough somewhere out there, that just we need a miracle, or we need a strong man like John McCain to see it. Now, you know,
isn't that though simply just reinforcing that notion? I mean, if God can pick Joan of Arc or Sarah Palin, or God's surrogate, in this case, John McCain, can pick Sarah Palin, it simply reinforces the notion of the need of a hierarchy.
Absolutely. It's not meant to be a way of supplanting hierarchy. It's just the way that somebody who is a commoner can perhaps imagine or fantasize that they too one day may be part of that splendid hierarchy, that they're not simply beneath it, that they might be themselves one of the elect if a miracle should happen.
And I mean, it's interesting because that theme, I mean, that theme is just huge in, I think, Republican politics, and this notion that, you know, there's an anointing on some level. It certainly has been that case, you know, just if you look at just presidential, Republican presidential politics, you can always predict who's going to be the next nominee based upon they have sort of like come before the court. Mm-hmm. And they've been knighted for the next for the next election. So I'm just curious about this notion of how this sort of same theme regenerates itself over and over again, because we hear in the Republican base this notion of this sort of like anti-establishment and this notion of going rogue is very important, and I'm an outsider. This all plays into that what you mentioned at the beginning, this notion of they keep regenerating it, but they follow the same sort of, I guess, paradigm.
Right. I mean, I guess I think about it in sort of these terms, which is when they say things like that, I think that they're thinking is a kind of the opposite of what they're thinking of is a sort of set of liberal institutions. I mean, liberals also believe that people have the capacity for greatness and excellence and extraordinariness, but liberals on the left, I think what we believe is that you need institutions, good public schools, good safety net, good welfare state, healthcare, all of these things you need to have in place so that everybody really has the capacity to express the kind of greatness that they're capable of. Conservatives see that, and all they see is bureaucracy, gray, sort of, you know, Britain in the 1950s, just stifling the kind of miracle that's waiting to happen. And so I think it's more as a kind of polemical argument against the bureaucratization of everyday life or something like that, that they're able to make the case of, you know, we stand for the outsider and all the rest of it. Because in their, you know, and Barack Obama really is the emblem to them of that, you know, went to all the right schools and all the rest of it. And I think that's why, you know, there's really an attraction towards these kind of outsiders. And you know, the fact of the matter is they sometimes win. I mean, Ronald Reagan, you know, was the son of an alcoholic father, poor, you know, didn't go to good schools, was a Hollywood actor, you know, was, I mean, we think of him now, he's remembered as such a statesman, but he was the laughingstock in sort of polite establishment circles throughout the 60s and 70s. Likewise, Richard Nixon. You know, so it's not just symbolism, you know, that there's something to what they're, you know, there's something to it that's more than just, you know, smoke and mirrors.
I want to ask you about this notion of, you mentioned Nixon, and I think it comes across in Nixon as much as anybody else, but it also in terms of Palin and in terms of Reagan and this notion of, I mean, I think you describe it as the politics of loss, and there is this notion in conservatism that they are always victims. Like there is this victimization and this notion. I mean, I think it's pretty clear. There's this notion that the sort of like emancipation of people, either socially or economically, infringes upon them, particularly if you're a white male, because it probably does.
Right.
But
I mean, I think that's the first thing to stress is that the language of victimization on the right is not completely fabricated. When the left is really doing its job with the labor movement, the women's movement, the civil rights movement, it is taking away power and privilege from people who have quite a bit of power and privilege. And when you take that away, there is a real loss there. And we shouldn't pretend otherwise. You don't free the slaves without getting rid of the slaveholder, you know. And that is true. And that's, like I said, that's when the left is doing its job. And so that's part of it. And then the second part of it, which I think is important to remember, is that it goes to the politics of reaction. Conservatives are not just defending a world from the past. They're defending a world that's under threat and under assault from a democratic force. And what they very early understood was that you have to find a new way of defending that world that speaks to the very aspirations of the revolutionary or reformist movement that you're opposing, right? You can't just reiterate the old claims. So one of the things that they found, and this goes back to Edmund Burke, he has a very long discussion in his classic, his sort of masterwork Against the French Revolution. He has this very long discussion of the abduction of Marie Antoinette and the royal family from the Palace of Versailles and the way by a Parisian mob, and that then they're then marched to Paris. And scholars always puzzle why this long, long discussion. And what I think is going on there is that Marie Antoinette really becomes the classic victim. She really is a victim. She's lost everything. She's not a tragic victim like an ancient tragedy where there's nothing you can do about it. She's a modern victim where the whole point is she's lost everything. Let us make her whole. And I think that's the genius of conservatism, is it taps into a very universal language of loss and victimization and uses it as an argument on behalf of restoration and counter-revolution.
And it's an argument that speaks even to that guy who's making 35 grand a year, and he sees his wife is sort of usurping his power within the household.
Absolutely.
He feels
Absolutely.
That loss. And so, and when you talk about the sort of the radicalism of the conservatives, or that notion that they are constantly trying to overthrow the establishment, it is because the establishment is not doing a good enough job at essentially halting progress.
Exactly. I mean, this is the thing that always strikes me, Barry Goldwater's Conscience of a Conservative, the very first paragraph, who is the enemy? It's not the welfare state, it's not the Democratic Party, it's not liberals, it's the establishment Republican Party, because they're so apologetic about their defense of capitalism. They don't even really defend capitalism. And so, you know, for every real conservative, your first enemy, your first line of attack is going to be the rest of the ruling class for basically falling down on the job. You need to kind of clear them out and come up with a much, much more forceful, powerful defense. I mean, Ayn Rand hated the business class, or a lot of the business class in America, because she thought they were just so wimpy and apologetic in their defense of capitalism. She wanted a full-throated, you know, hardcore moral defense. And that's what conservatism is always about, is trying to find the kind of, you know, the hard line and the high ground upon which to defend these orders.
And they also are sort of challenged with this notion of keep finding new boogeymen, right? I mean, isn't that sort of like the conservatives' most difficult, I guess, assignment is to find the boogeyman who is taking away this stuff, which is why they have to sort of, you know, 8 years ago it was the gays who were coming
right.
for us. And now, sadly for them, you know, not enough of the people sort of can demonize gay people. So now it's on to the Muslims, and now back to the socialists and the commies and the
right.
I mean, that's basically their hardest task, isn't it?
Well, yes and no. Sometimes it's actually a very simple task. Like I said, when the left is doing its job, the right has a very simple task of identifying the enemy, because there's a real enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that the gay rights movement was a real enemy to the right, because it is completely about toppling the privileged heterosexual family and heterosexual relationships and heterosexuality. It's saying, you know, you don't have that, you don't occupy that privileged position, you should not occupy it. And that's why I think the battle over gay marriage was for a time so ferocious. And it's what's puzzling to me, I've never been able to figure out, is why it is that the right lost that, or seems to be losing that battle. I mean, there's still a long way to go. So sometimes
I think probably part of the problem is that in fact there is this is one of those cases where there in fact is no price to be paid. I mean, it's very hard. It's one thing to say, okay, I don't have a job because that
right.
woman or that black person has taken my job, But you can't, I mean, it's a real stretch to say, gosh, the reason why I'm not getting along with my wife is because those gay guys got married in Massachusetts.
Right, right. I mean, I would say the other thing is that, of course, gays and lesbians are kind of universally distributed across the population, and lo and behold, lots of conservatives, there's gays and lesbians in their families, and that's, you know, the other thing that becomes a little bit trickier. But so sometimes they don't have to invent boogeymen. Sometimes, though, and this is where I think you were going, like right now, I think that they do. And it's very interesting watching the rhetoric of the Tea Party of the last year and a half. And I, at the end of the book, and I wrote this, you know, last year when everybody thought the Tea Party was really riding high. Now it doesn't seem to be the case. But I read the Tea Party at the time as a sign of the beginning of the end of the Republican Party, in part because of the shrillness and unreality of the rhetoric, you know, that Obama is a Kenyan socialist Muslim. You know, there's no way, you know, there's no way in hell that Obama is a socialist, or, you know, the other two things as well. But there was, you know, there was a time when McCarthy called the Democrats socialists and communists. There was some truth to what he was saying, because there was a kind of, there was a sort of socialist project that lay behind parts of the New Deal, and there was some truth to it. Today there isn't. And what's most interesting to me is, somewhere inside of the Republican Party, they know it. And the reason you can know that they know it is that they have not been able to line up behind a frontliner, behind a frontrunner. All this scrambling you've seen for the last 6 months, where they, you know, it's Michelle Bachmann one day, Rick Perry the other, and so on and so forth, all of it is a symptom of a kind of disarray, which I think is symptomatic of the fact that there is no real left that they can rally against. And because if there were, there would be, you know, the Republicans know how to do discipline very, very well.
Right.
And there's not. And so no matter how many times they'll tell you he's a socialist, if they really believed it, their actions would be otherwise than it is, than they are. And I think it's not until you see a real left, and I don't even mean Occupy Wall Street, right, which could be the beginnings, but I mean, you know, a real left that's going to make a real stab for power, not just power in an electoral sense, but really divest these elites of their privileges. Not until you see something like that are you going to see the rebirth of a new conservative movement. And I think that's where we are right now. And that's why all this rhetoric seems so insane, because, you know, in their heart of hearts, they know Obama is, I wouldn't say one of them by any stretch, but he's certainly not the enemy.
Right. I mean, that's sort of the saddest irony, isn't it, is that the failure of the left is ultimately could very well be the destruction that leads to the destruction of the right as we know it at this time.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Well, that's a perfectly sad moment to end on, but I think you're right. It's I guess this is where the left is playing the ultimate rope-a-dope strategy.
I don't think it's playing any strategy. I mean, it's pretty much making the best probably of a bad circumstance. But, you know, I do think this is why Occupy is a very interesting thing to watch, because my suspicion is that it is the opening shot across the bow, and it's going to take quite a while, but with time, that movement is going to become an extraordinarily formidable movement against the sort of inequality that we've seen in this country. And then you're going to start to see some really profound rethinking on the right, and then some very innovative political organization along the lines of the creation of the Christian right in the first place.
Well, from your mouth to God's ears, Corey Robin, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
the program, Richard Wolff. He is a professor of economics at the New School, has a weekly show on WBAI in New York, and author of several books. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
So I want to talk about, I've seen some of your work. You're talking about what's going on in Greece and how, at least in terms of the reaction by the establishment, by the economic elite, we can maybe anticipate some of that here. In fact, we're already seeing some of it in terms of austerity. But first, give us a sense of this deal that supposedly has been made or has stuck in terms of Greece, and what the implications are for the Greek people.
Well, I think that the basic deal that has happened in Greece, if you put aside all the minor details, is really no different from the kind of deal that has often been reached between a company that borrowed too much money from a bank or a homeowner that borrowed too much from a lender for his or her mortgage. That is, you reach a point where you explain to the lender, I can't possibly pay back what I owe you, so I'm going to either have to declare bankruptcy and you get nothing, or you work something out with me to reduce the totality of my debt so I can manage to make the payments to a lower amount, and we'll each kind of suffer the consequences of all of this. What the Greeks did was basically go to their lenders and say, give us a break, reduce the amount we owe you. Well, the answer of the lender, in the case of Greece, the banks and the European Community and the International Monetary Fund, was rather like the answer you get from banks here. And after a lot of negotiation, their debt was reduced by a little, but in exchange, they had to give up all kinds of things. They had to make commitments as a country to honor the new set of bonds that replaced the old set at a lower total amount, but they had to make commitments to basically forego all kinds of things that modern societies used to think they were entitled to. I'll give you just three examples. One, the Greek government agreed to lower the minimum wage of Greek people 20%. That is imposing on the poorest people in Greece, and Greece is a poor country, a cut of extraordinary size in order to free up money that used to be paid to them as minimum wage and use it to pay off lenders. Number two, the Greek government agreed to lay off 150,000 of the 800,000 people they currently employ in order, again, to free up government money to pay off the lenders and to have that as a fixed commitment going forward. And the third item that I would point out is this deal that was reached still leaves Greece with more of a debt than it, in fact, can reasonably expect to pay. It's a little bit like a person who gets a deal from their on their mortgage to reduce the debt on their house by $100,000, but they're still in no position, because they're unemployed, to pay the lower amount of mortgage each month. And so in a few months, they're going to see reapplication for bankruptcy, which, by the way, happens in this country all the time. And so if you lay off 150,000 workers, which the Greek government has pledged to do, in a country whose current unemployment rate is already 19%, you're going to see more people out of work, less money spent, therefore less revenue taken in by the Greek government, and then the whole situation is going to play itself out again. So I think the truth of it is, this is a game in which you shift the burden of this crisis onto the mass of people, and you buy yourself some time to try to come up with a solution. But since that's what all of these arrangements have been doing for the last 4 or 5 years, and we're still nowhere near out of the woods, I am not hopeful about the future in Greece, and neither are the people of Greece, and neither are the major banks that will hold the new debt of Greece and are wondering whether they will ever get paid either.
Now let's talk about how Greece found itself in this situation, because the money that was lent to Greece essentially ended up going back and buying the products of other European countries.
Exactly.
So This was money that was loaned by other countries, other institutions, to fund essentially their own economies, to turn the Greeks into bigger consumers, both from a national perspective and from an individual perspective. So, I mean, just outline that for us.
Well, it's a very interesting situation, and it has an exact parallel here in the United States. So actually, let me begin with the parallel here and show you how the Greeks are the same story. Starting in the 1970s here in the United States, real wages, that is the actual amount of money an average American worker got, adjusted for the prices he or she had to pay, stopped rising. And literally, we get today the same average real wage per hour in the United States as we had back in 1978. Nothing has gone up. But Americans still wanted to enjoy the American dream. Advertisers were telling us, as they always do, how much better off we'll be if we have this vacation, that car, this diet, and so on. And so Americans responded by not wanting to tell their children they couldn't go to a university and so forth, by borrowing wild amounts of money. And for the last 30 years, this country has lived on growing debt until that couldn't be continued anymore, because you can't keep accumulating debt on a stagnant wage base. And then our economy collapsed in 2007 as a result of all of this. Well, the Greek story is more or less the same. With the unification of Europe that happened at the end of the 1990s, the Greeks found themselves in an economically disadvantageous position. They were part now of a unified Europe that had much, much stronger economies in France and Germany than existed in places like Greece or Spain or Portugal or Italy. And the Germans and the French were determined to keep industry there, not to have their industries move to Greece and so on. And so the Greeks found themselves with no way to succeed economically in competition with their more powerful other parts of a unified Europe. And the European parts that were doing well, mainly Germany and France, said, okay, here's what we'll do. We will lend you the money so that you can keep buying our products, rather like the American upper classes lent money to the mass of American workers to buy the products that kept those in charge of the American economy earning their profits. And the Greeks kept doing it until they couldn't do it anymore, until they had built up a level of debt based on an economy which was puttering along but was not able to sustain that debt. You might think of Greece as the subprime borrower in Europe, a little bit like there were subprime mortgages here in the United States. And after a certain point, the system collapses because you cannot keep hyping people's purchasing power with debt when you don't give them the chance economically to earn the wages, or in the case of Greece, to produce the outputs that can keep them a viable economic system. And that has to be confronted. If you want a unified Europe, then you have to equalize the conditions across the continent. The French and Germans and the Scandinavians were unwilling to do that. They wanted a unified Europe in which they're even stronger than they were before. But the only way that's going to work is if the weaker parts of it become even weaker than before. And in the end, that's not a viable way to have a unified Europe, any more than the kind of things we're doing between the 99 and 1% here is a viable way for the future of the United States.
Can you help me with making a distinction between the privately held debt and the publicly held debt? In other words, you know, the scenario you talk about in this country where we have stagnant wages for over 30 years while simultaneously having increased productivity. So those profits
right.
are going somewhere. They're ending up in shareholders' hands. They're ending up in the CEO's hands or the board of
right.
directors' hands. But when we talk about Greece, we're talking about, and you know, we can also, we have a similar analogy in this country to a certain extent, but we're talking about publicly held debt. In other words, the government holding the debt, as opposed to sort of the credit card bills of all the individuals in the country. Make that distinction for me, because I'm not quite clear where those lines are drawn, particularly in the context of Greece.
Okay, fine. If you look at the different conditions of the different countries in Europe, you very quickly see something. And that is, in some cases, like Greece, for example, the debt is the debt of the government. individual Greeks do not borrow money in anything like the way, for example, Americans do. That's why you don't see across Greece a foreclosure movement like you had here in the United States, because the country in Greece borrowed the money. And then you might think of it this way. They turned around and paid their workers decent rising wages. And the only way that Greek workers were able to get decent rising wages was because they had a generous government, which was able to be generous because it did the borrowing. In a place like Spain, it isn't so much the government's debt that's the problem. It is the problem of individual Spanish families borrowing money to sustain a lifestyle that they could not afford based on the wages they actually earned and the economic system they live on. In the end, it doesn't matter all that much, except politically, because the lenders are the same. It's either the wealthy big corporations and the banks they put their money in France and Germany, lending to the Italian government or to the Spanish family or to the regional government in Portugal or whatever. The basic problem is always the same: economic uneven development that is handled in a capitalist system, not by saying, well, we have to equalize the different regions so they can hold their own in a kind of mutual economic exchange. We don't work it that way. We ought to, but we don't. Instead, we allow those who are relatively better off to use their advantages to stay that way, and in any case, often to make the disadvantages of the poorer parts of the country or the poorer parts of the population, or in Europe's case, the poorer parts of the continent, become more and more dependent and more unequal. And then we paper over the situation of inequality by a lending program that goes from the successful to the unsuccessful, from the rich to the poor, from those making more money to those who they're taking the money from. We imagine for a decade or two that this is all a wonderful arrangement. Let me underscore, you know, the job of a banker, the way we teach it in economics programs, is to be a quote-unquote prudent lender.
Right.
We're all supposed to trust the bank to put our money in the deposits, and then they're supposed to be the experts who only lend out to a prudent borrower. When the loan goes bad, it doesn't just mean that the borrower didn't behave properly. It means also that the lender didn't do his job. All those banks in Europe, all with their government regulators, were lending like there's no tomorrow to the Greek and Spanish and Portuguese, both the public borrowers there and the private borrowers there, in ways that are now obviously imprudent. And we do not punish the lenders anything like we punish the borrowers when these loans go bad, and that's not a good way to manage it, putting it even aside.
Right. Well, theoretically, that's why the lenders get interest, isn't it? I mean, isn't it because aren't we always taught that the reason why you get a return on the money you lend is because baked into that interest is the risk that some of your borrowers won't return that money? And so you're taking some type of risk, and the flip side of that is, of course, sometimes you've got to eat it, and they're not eating it is essentially the problem.
That's right, because they never expected, never factored in, and never really believed what it is they tell us as the teachers we're supposed to teach everybody. You learned your lesson well. You understand that the appropriate reward for the risk you take as a lender is that you charge interest. And that is supposed to compensate you for those eventualities in which you don't get paid back. But obviously, the system only works so long as there isn't what we used to call a run on the lender. That is, there aren't so many people unable to pay back that your interest doesn't begin to cover what it is. And that is always a result of the underlying economic situation. And they don't want to have to pay for that, so they are demanding the kinds of deals. The French and German banks in the case of Greece, all banks in the United States in the case of our larger population, they don't want to pay the cost of this collapsed economic system. So they want government bailouts. They want rewritten loan covenants. They want to hold on to as much in a declining situation as they can, and what they don't face, neither in Europe nor here, is that if you succeed at pushing the costs of this crisis onto the mass of people in lower wages, in high unemployment, in government cutbacks, you are not solving the problem. You are perpetuating the very inequalities that got you into it.
Right. I mean, the idea is that these austerity measures are actually going to shrink the economy and therefore shrink the revenues, and you're still at that. It's a self-fulfilling loop in some respects. And in fact,
right.
for when we talk about Spain and we talk about the United States, to the extent that we have an increasing deficit in debt, that is as much of a function of the recession and the incapacity for and the lack of revenue that's coming into the government as it is anything else. I mean, not just on the spending side, it's as much on the revenue side as anything else.
Absolutely. And because the fear of those who are in business and those who are rich, that if you open up the real question of the revenue side, whether it's in a place like Greece or in the United States, they are very afraid that the obvious finger will point to them. If you're going to deal with the government's debt problems by finding, quote-unquote, new sources of revenue, then in a time of unemployment, of cutting minimum wages, of all the rest, you're not going to point the finger at the mass of people, partly because they don't have the money, and partly because if you tried, you'd have a revolution on your hands. So you end up saying, well, let's go get it from the rich and the corporations. They've actually enjoyed tax cuts of huge proportions over the last 30 or 40 years. They are richer relative to the rest of the population today than they have been for 30 or 40 years. So if we start talking revenue, the finger is going to point at them, which is why you get this peculiar imbalance in all these discussions of government or private debt, namely a discussion only about austerity programs, cut back spending. Nobody wants to remember that a budget has two sides, the expenditure side, but also the revenue side. And to reduce a deficit or to reduce a government debt, you can do that by looking at the revenue side. And here in the United States, it's even more dramatic. You know, the top income tax rate in the United States in the 50s and 60s was 91%. Today, the top rate is 35%. It doesn't take rocket science to understand that if the government's stimulus of a broken economy wanted to happen without raising our government debt, the way to go is to go back to the levels, or at least toward the levels of income tax on wealthy people that we used to have, that we had in the 50s and 60s when, by the way, unemployment was lower than it is today and economic growth faster than it is today. And that way we would give the government the money with which to get us out of this crisis without increasing anybody's deficit or debt. And the reason we never discuss that, why our political campaigns are campaigns between those who want to cut expenditure a lot and those who want to cut it less, is because we've been able, or they've been able, to render the revenue side of the budget a kind of taboo topic.
Right. And commensurate with that sort of income disparity becomes a serious disparity in the political power of the various groups.
Right, and you can hardly blame them, right? If you give more and more of your wealth to a smaller and smaller slice of your population, those people who are in the privileged sector would be strange indeed in the history of the human race if they didn't recognize the vulnerability of this very good fortune they're having and take steps to protect themselves by making sure that the one-person, one-vote democratic system they have around them is not used to enable politics to undo what they've gotten in the economy. So controlling politics is obviously the way they have to go, and they've understood that in every one of these countries.
In terms of gaining some type of economic stability, what are the options, or what could have been the options available to Greece, and contrast that with the options that are available to the United States? Because while I believe that we are going to see, and we have to a certain extent, I mean, if you look at how many government jobs have been lost over the past couple of years, and the talk of cutting Social Security or cutting Medicare, by either raising the age or changing the CPI, whatever it is. We're talking about austerity in this country as well.
Absolutely.
But we have more options than Greece because of the nature of our economy and our control of our currency.
Yes, that is no question the case. We remain the biggest and strongest economy in the world. We have incredible natural resources. We have a highly trained and skilled labor force. I could not agree more that the conditions needed to be able to solve this problem are all here. What we lack is an economic system that can put them together. I mean, the simplest way of articulating that, and this is true for Greece also, is that if you have 10 or 20% of your people unemployed who want and need jobs, if the proportion of your industrial capacity, your tools, your equipment, machines, and so on, that are sitting idle is in the nature of 30%, which it is both in this country and in Greece, then you're talking about a failed economic system that cannot put together the people who need and want to work with the tools, equipment, and raw materials they need to work with and on to produce the wealth that we desperately need to deal with our poverty, with our need for childcare, with our need for proper education systems, and so on. And the answer to that, I think, for the Greeks, as for the United States, and I'm a little bit a proud American here, is to say we have that answer, at least in the short run, from our own history. I mean, if you go back to the 1930s, when we had, let's say, 1933-34, unemployment rate 25%, three times what it is today. Roosevelt, who comes in as a kind of centrist Democrat, changes his politics radically through pressure from below, and what does he do? Does he impose an austerity the way we discuss it in terms of Greece or the United States? Absolutely not. He does the opposite. He creates the Social Security system. In the middle of a Great Depression, not only does he not cut back Social Security, as you rightly pointed out, we're discussing and doing now, he creates Social Security. He says to the Americans over 65 who've done a lifetime of work, I'm now going to give you a pension as the government for the rest of your life. He creates the unemployment compensation system. We never had that before either, in which he says to the then tens of millions of Americans unemployed, I'm going to give you a year or two of weekly paychecks because you're unemployed. And then finally, he creates a federal jobs program. He puts to work 12.5 million Americans between 1934 and 1941, working and getting an income from the federal government. All of that took an enormous amount of money. It wasn't cutting back programs for the mass of people. It was giving them jobs and income. It was what you might call trickle-up economics, in which the economy as a whole was to be stimulated by helping those at the bottom who were suffering the most. In my own humble opinion, that would be even better policy today in the United States and Greece than it was then, and it would certainly work better than the trickle-down economics of bailing out the folks at the top have been able to work over the last 5 years.
In the context of this country, what do you think would be the best mechanism to do that? And this would be money that the government should actually be borrowing more money. We have historically low interest rates. Is that what you would suggest in the context of this country?
No, I would, again, be a bit more faithful. Not that I want to overdo it. Franklin Roosevelt had his problems, too. But I would rather take the page from him. He did not simply raise the money to create Social Security, unemployment compensation, and a federal jobs program by borrowing. What has to be understood is he went to the business community of the United States and to the rich. After all, being a Roosevelt, that was his milieu anyway. And he said to them, look, you got to help me. You've got to give me the money with which to take care of the mass of people going through the worst depression in the history of capitalism. Because if you don't, the CIO, the socialists, the communists, and remember those organizations were very strong then, they're going to come down the road and they're going to offer you a much poorer deal than I'm offering you. You give me the money. I will go to the unions and the socialists and the communists. I will provide a mass social welfare program that they will have to agree with me about. And in exchange, I'll agree to get them to agree not to interfere with your business. You will remain the shareholders, the boards of directors, and all the rest. And basically, he split the business community. Half of them were not persuaded by what he said and became the sworn enemies of what we later call the New Deal. But the other half of the business community and the rich agreed with him, rather like a Warren Buffett today agrees with raising taxes on the rich and so on. They said yes, they were persuaded by his argument. And between the support from the mass of the Democratic Party below and half of the wealthy folks at the top, you got the kind of support for Roosevelt that enabled the New Deal to be pushed through, that enabled the mass of people never to suffer the way they have would have had otherwise, and you made Mr. Roosevelt the first president in American history to be reelected four times because he became a virtual saint for half the population in the country. It seems to me we ought to learn that the way to stimulate the economy is to do the kinds of things he did, you know, adjusted for our conditions today, but not to pay for it by ever more borrowing. Deficits and debts are real problems. The way to deal with it is to at least move part of the way back to what Roosevelt did, which was to raise taxes on the wealthy and to raise taxes on corporations. I mean, just to give you a footnote of history, in 1942 and 3, Roosevelt sent to the Congress of the United States a proposal for a 100% top income tax bracket. What that means is above a certain amount, you earn anything, you give all of it to the government. It's in effect a maximum salary or wage or income, as well as a minimum for poor people. You have a maximum for the rich. The Congress went ballistic about that, of course, led by the Republican Party, again, of course. But in the end, a compromise was dealt with, and in the middle of the 1940s, they accepted a 94% top income tax bracket rate, so that rich people above a certain amount had to give the government 94 cents of every dollar they earned and could only keep six. And even in the 1950s and 60s, the top rate was 91%. A rate endorsed by Republican as well as Democratic presidents, by Republican as well as Democratic Congresses. And the argument in those days was, we've just been through a Great Depression, followed by a world war. We have to rebuild our economy and society. And the corporations and the rich who have the most to help do that are the ones who ought to be paying the most. And everybody thought that was reasonable and patriotic, and as it should be. And if we're going through the fifth year of a crisis now, as I believe we all understand we are, it seems to me the same logic ought to move us in the same direction, and that we have a lesson from our own history that I find it strange, as I look around me, that there's such an amnesia about it.
Well, as a political calculation, I mean, are we anywhere close to that? In other words, is it going to take, you know, the difference between then and now, of course, is that we do have Social Security now. And that we do have Medicare, and we do have we still are living under the New Deal, and it's almost letting the air out of the political tire in terms of providing that pressure from the bottom up, and it's also it's not putting enough pressure to divide the business community, as it were, with the sense that they could be looking at a worse deal down the road.
Well, I think you're right, but I would inflect it slightly differently. I think that the majority of those at the top, whether they're corporates or executives or folks with a lot of money, still believe, and I understand how that might be, that they're going to get out of this crisis without having to give up much of anything. They've spent the last 30 or 40 years basically rolling back the New Deal. Whether you look at the tax rates I quoted to you that have come way back down again, or you look at the repeal of things like the Glass-Steagall Act in terms of the financial regulation, they've really done pretty well, and they're still hoping that they can slither out of the current morass without having to have the kind of comeuppance that Roosevelt basically imposed on them. And, you know, I can't predict the future any better than anyone else. Maybe they're right. Maybe if I were like them, I too would try to hold on. But I think in the remarks you get from folks like Warren Buffett and others, there is a growing worry among the folks at the top too that they could be making a classic tragic miscalculation in which they keep holding on, they keep not wanting to have to pay the costs of a crisis that they more than anyone else is responsible for, even though it's a systemic problem, that they may be making a terrible miscalculation and risking the entirety of the system they have come to depend on. And there are more and more voices among them that are saying that to them. They don't have the force of the President of the United States, obviously, although I did notice that Mr. Obama and Mr. Buffett found ways to help each other and continue to do so, that those are hints in a certain direction. But you're right. We don't have the mass base of pressure from below that was formed and organized in the CIO and the Socialist and Communist parties. We still have only the beginnings of the Tea Party type stuff on the right and the Occupy movement on the left, and those are much less focused and developed. But I think the direction in which things are going is more and more in that. I don't think that the Europeans are the only place that is having more general strikes in the last 12 months than they did in the previous 35 years. I think the turmoil of the austerity programs there is a preview of what is coming here as the rising austerity here, which takes a different form from Europe because of our conventions here. But if you look at Harrisburg, PA, declaring bankruptcy, and Stockton, California, and the entire Jefferson County in Alabama, or Central Falls in Rhode Island, all of those situations are a rising crescendo of closing down the economic well-being of the mass of people, and that can't go on forever, especially in a country that prides itself on the imaginary notion that we're all in the middle class and that we live in a country that is somehow pre-God given the right to have a better life for each generation. That's all gone now. And as the realization of that settles in, I think you're going to see a lot of political turmoil here that Americans are not prepared for.
Professor Richard Wolff from the New School. You can check out his site at rdwolff.com. We'll put a link up at majority.fm. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation. It was good to talk with you.
Good to talk to you.
It's Sam Cedar. Introducing whiny-ass, teeny-baby conservatives to the truth. Wow, wow, conservatives. That's you crying. The left just got a little bit louder on The Majority Report.
It's fantastic. Should I play the whole clip or what point?
I didn't hear the clip.
All right, let's play this clip. Apparently, the Nuge. The Nuge. Ted Nugent is being investigated by the Secret Service because of his threatening remarks towards the president at the annual National Rifle Association in St. Louis. Let's hear it.
If you can't get a couple of hundred people each of you, some of you, I bet you can get a couple thousand. Your goal should be able to get a couple of thousand people.
Hold on. He's talking to two empty chairs. The Nuge. Well, he's got his cowboy hat on the table, and he's talking to two empty chairs.
Per person who's here to vote for Mitt Romney in November, if you don't know that our government is wiping its ass with the Constitution, you're living under a rock someplace. And that there's a dead soldier, an airman, a marine, a seaman, a hero of the military that just got his legs blown off for the U.S. Constitution. And we got a president and attorney general who doesn't even like the Constitution. We got four Supreme Court justices who don't believe in the Constitution. Does everybody know here that four of the Supreme Court justices not only determined you don't have the right to keep and bear arms, four Supreme Court justices sign their name to a declaration that Americans have no fundamental right to self-defense. That sounds like a stoned hippie. That doesn't sound like a Supreme Court anything.
First of all, I like the automatic weapons that the guys are holding in the background of this video. And I also like how a Ted Nugent is completely out of his mind and talking nonsense.
It sounds like a supremely intellectually vacuous punk.
Wait, did we skip over something? Was he talking about himself? Did he say I was, or that might have gotten clipped?
To think that a human could think that humans don't have a basic right to self-defense is so bizarre to me as to my brain can't accept the information. And if you want more of those kinds of evil anti-American people in the Supreme Court, then don't get involved and let Obama take office again. Because I tell you this right now, if Barack Obama becomes the president in November again, I will either be dead or in jail by this time next year. Being at the NRA event, God bless you, good indicator.
He's either going to be dead or in jail. I wonder what that means. Maybe we should get the Secret Service in on that.
If you can't go home and get everybody in your lives to clean house in this vile, evil, America-hating administration, I don't even know what you're made out of. If you can't galvanize and promote and recruit people to vote for Mitt Romney, we're done. We'll be a suburb of Indonesia next year.
Wait, how does that happen? How do we become a suburb of Indonesia? What the hell does that even mean? I love the crowd shots. There is one woman in a room full of white guys.
Our president and attorney general, our vice president, Hillary Clinton, they're criminals. They're criminals. And if you take that adamant we the people defiance, remember we're Americans because we defied the king. We didn't negotiate and compromise with the king. We defied the emperors. We are patriots. We are Braveheart.
Freedom!
I didn't know Ted Nugent was around back then and that he did those things. Yeah, pretty amazing.
I think he meant we're all Mel Gibson's here.
I got to brush up on my history.
Battlefield and chop their heads off in November. Any questions?
Wow. That video from Right Wing Watch. So the Nuge letting loose and investigated by Secret Service. You know, I don't blame him because that guy sounds a little bit untethered. The champion of the Republican Party now. And like I said today on CNN, I don't think this race is over until Newt Gingrich decides he has no more books to sell. So he could be with us for quite a while. But Mitt Romney, talking about his victory on CNN today, had this to say. If you have any question as to whether or not he is pivoting to the general election, or I don't even know how to explain what he's thinking here. Yes, I do. Let's play it.
By the way, I'm in this race because I care about Americans. I'm not concerned about the very poor. We have a safety net there. If it needs a repair, I'll
Stop.
Fix it.
You understand, folks, that the poor, they're not Americans. All the poor in this country are Europeans. We know that. He's not concerned about the poor. Why should he be? Because they're doing great. I mean, except for the poor part. But they're great. Are you kidding? We take so much tax money from people, Americans, real Americans, and give it to the poor that they're driving around in Bentleys. They're living it up. Dude, they take that $200 of food stamps they get, and it's party time. Go back to the beginning so people can hear this and just let it sink in. And then he realizes, I think by the end of the interview, he said the wrong thing because he changes what he says at the end. Go ahead.
By the way, I'm in this race because I care about Americans. I'm not concerned about the very poor. We have a safety net there. If it needs a repair, I'll fix it. I'm not concerned about the very rich. They're doing just fine.
That's
I'm concerned about the very heart of America, the 90-95% of Americans who right now are struggling, and I'll continue to take that message across the nation.
All right, I know I said last question, but I got to ask you. You just said, I'm not concerned about the very poor because they have a safety net. And I think there are lots of very poor Americans who are struggling who would say, that sounds odd. Can you explain that?
Well, you had to finish the sentence, Soledad. I said, I'm not concerned about the very poor that have a safety net, but if it has holes in it, I will repair them.
Got it. Okay.
The challenge right now, we will hear from the Democrat Party the plight of the poor.
Oh!
And there's no question, it's not good being poor, and we have a safety net to help those that are very poor. But my campaign is focused on middle-income Americans. My campaign, you can choose where to focus. You can focus on the rich. That's not my focus. You can focus on the very poor. That's not my focus. My focus is on middle-income Americans, retirees living on Social Security, people who can't find work. Folks that have kids that are getting ready to go to college.
Okay, we don't need to hear any more of this. Now, so the retirees who are living on, if they're lucky, I guess $16,000 a year, they're hurt. The very poor, though, they're fine. In fact, they're not just fine. They're taking advantage of the real heart of America. And that's not what I said, Soledad. I said they have a safety net.
I wonder if that something dropping you heard was like Mitt Romney's campaign manager's jaw hitting the floor.
I think that was people at CNN going, God, man, what is with this dude? So there you have it. Mitt Romney. Yeah, people can focus on it. That's not my focus. I'm not concerned with the poor. Of course he's not, because he's running still in the Republican primary. And in the Republican primary, you have to demonize the poor, because you need that resentment from the middle, from the middle class. You want to draw, and you know who's screwing you, don't you, middle class? The poor. And we know who all they are. They're not Americans. Speaking of absurd, and, you know, I've spoken about this, too, but it bears repeating. And Mitt Romney has given us the opportunity today. You know, I've talked in the past about how Mitt Romney, the problem isn't that Mitt Romney is rich. I think I said this on Up with Chris Hayes last weekend. The problem isn't that Mitt Romney is rich. The problem isn't that Mitt Romney got a leg up from his father. Not just in the form of his father being fairly well connected as the president of one of the major U.S. car companies, or as the governor of a fairly large state in this country, or in the form that Mitt Romney got, you know, just a small sort of little gift of an investment that was worth, I don't know, tens of thousands of dollars when he was a grad student. The problem is, he doesn't recognize that that was an advantage. He's not even capable of contextualizing it and understanding that he was given a leg up. It is that classic saying. I can't remember who said it now. George Bush was born on third base and thought he hit a triple. That's the problem, is that Mitt Romney's constitutionally incapable of understanding that he had a benefit. Never mind the fact that he just had a benefit because he was born a white guy. Statistically speaking, you're going to earn more being born a white guy than you will being born just about anything else in this country. That's just the fact. And so I don't begrudge Mitt Romney for his father helping him out. I hope to help my kid out. I got help from my parents. I wasn't saddled with college debt. I had the opportunity to take chances and risks, even if they weren't giving me money when I entered the job or workforce, because I knew if I hit rock bottom, if I was living on the streets, they'd be there. And here's Mitt Romney telling a bunch of college students at Otterbein University in Ohio. Well, he's saying one thing, but what he's really saying is that I don't even recognize that I had an advantage. I can't even conceive of the fact that the vast majority of people in this country don't have the same advantages I had. So I'm incapable of making an assessment about what they're doing with their lives. Here's that audio.
This kind of divisiveness, this attack of success, is very different than what we've seen in our country's history. We've always encouraged young people, take a shot, go for it. Take a risk, get the education, borrow money if you have to from your parents, start a business. I was with a guy named Jimmy John. You know Jimmy John? Yeah, you guys know.
Borrow money from your parents. Start a business. Jimmy John got a $20,000 loan, I guess, from his dad. Most Americans can't raise $2,000. So, you know, 50, what was that stat? It was something 50% of Americans can't raise $2,000 in the event that they have any type of emergency. Does Mitt Romney really think that the problem is that these kids at this university? Now, we know we got $1 trillion worth of student debt. So they're borrowing money. On the other hand, we're told these kids shouldn't be borrowing money. In fact, we're going to double the interest rate on them. We're not going to let them get out of the deal with private loans through bankruptcy. We're just not going to allow it. If you're a corporation, you go bankrupt, that's okay. You can get protection for your creditors. Not if you're a student. Not if you're a former student. Does Mitt Romney really believe that the problem with young people today is they're too shy to ask their parents for $20,000 to go start a business? No, the problem is that there's not the opportunity for most people to take a risk because they have nothing to fall back upon. That's the real problem with Mitt Romney. He doesn't have even an inkling of this reality. He's not even aware that it exists.
You know, you'll recall that Mitt Romney's advisors had told the British press that Mitt Romney was their guy because he understands and shares an Anglo-Saxon heritage in a way that the White House could never understand. Apparently, however, Mitt Romney's inherent and intrinsic a-holeness trumps his Anglo-Saxon-ness. Because it seems that his incapacity, I mean, he really, this guy's got something wrong with him. Because if he's not telling his supporters that their cookies are pieces of crap, that their lemonade is sour, that their restaurants are just places for him to come in and take a dump, essentially. He's going to Britain and says during an NBC News interview that there were disconcerting signs about Britain's readiness to host the Olympics. It's hard to know just how well it will turn out, he said. There are a few things that were disconcerting. The stories about the private security firm not having enough people. No, not the story about the fact that poor people were taken down and made to sleep under a bridge. That's not where he was at with this. He was just talking about, they're sort of incompetent. Supposed strike of the immigration and customs officials. Now, obviously, that's not something which is encouraging. And then he also said, you know, we took a lot of pride in our volunteers in our community coming together. But the question here is, quote, do they come together and celebrate the Olympic moment? That's something which we can only find out when the games actually begin. And in response, the Daily Mail Online had this headline. Who invited him? U.S. presidential hopeful Mitt Romney questions British public's appetite for the games during visit to London. He's getting hammered. And apparently the Daily Telegraph said that when Cameron, Prime Minister of Great Britain,
was asked directly about Romney's comments, the prime minister said he would give the presumptive Republican presidential nominee a positive message when they meet this morning. And he said, "We are holding the Olympic Games in one of the busiest, most active, bustling cities anywhere in the world. Of course, it's easier if you hold Olympic Games in the middle of nowhere." Referring to Romney having presided over the 2002 Salt Lake City in Utah / nowhere games. So just so you understand how this works, you've got Anglo-Saxons. I'm trying to do a Venn diagram here with my hands. Anglo-Saxons here. The White House outside of that Venn diagram there. And then apparently also a Venn diagram of a-holes that goes like that. And you'll see it crosses over Anglo-Saxons. And Mitt Romney's right there in that little segment of the Venn diagram. So kudos to you, Mitt Romney. And what else did he do? He what did he forget? He forgot the opposition leader's name in the middle of a press conference. Was it Miliband? Yeah, I'm not running for president. And also, I'm not an a-hole. Arguably.
Sticks and stones may break his bones, but conservative lies will only make him stronger. Sam Cedar.
Go to calling from an 847 area code. Are you there, or is your phone just butt dialed me again?
All right, yes, I am here. My name is Joe. I'm in Wisconsin.
Hey, Joe.
I'm a libertarian. Debate you.
I'm sorry?
I'm a libertarian, and I'd like to debate you.
Fantastic. Let's do this.
What
would you like to? Is there a particular issue that you would like to talk about, or what?
Well, I saw a video of you from last December or November on your show, just inviting libertarians to debate. And you were just talking about the utopianism of it and talking about Somalia.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of wondering if you have any questions for me, frankly.
Yes. How do you believe in such fantastical notions?
Well, I could answer how you invited libertarians to answer how when was the last time the free market existed in the country. And I would argue that it has never existed in anything you could really call a country, because a country has the governmental apparatus is a state, and part of the definition of the state is a monopoly on distributing public goods and services. So I would argue that in no society that has been governed by a single country has any kind of libertarian utopian anarchy ever existed.
Right, I agree totally. So, and yet you think it can exist.
I think it can. I think it doesn't necessarily require the abolition of government per se, or it doesn't require the abolition of governance or any kind of social or economic order of the day, any kind of dynamic social order. But we can still have governance in existence. I just think it has to be acceded to voluntarily. And I would even go a step further than the libertarians who embrace the Constitution by saying that even the Constitution was not put on the American public through consent. It was really drafted by 55 people who had the ability to choose to foist
right.
this government on the whole populace that didn't have the ability to choose whether to be governed by the British, the Americans, the founders, or anybody else, or themselves.
So you see my point here. I mean, I could say to you, okay, well then, how about this? Everybody can assent to the Constitution and our governance here, and if you don't like it, you know, leave. And you'll tell me, well, there's nowhere for you to go, because then you have to assent to somebody else's governing thing. And this is why I say it's a utopian and a fantasy land. And then what happens is what libertarians say to me, well, They give an example. You know, do you think that world peace is possible? Total peace? And I say, probably not. And they go, but you still aspire for that. But the problem is that when you aspire for more freedom, as you talk about, or I'm not sure whatever the term is you use, and I want to put words in your mouth, but as you pursue that, what happens is that knowing that you can never get there, the problem is that all you do is unshackle the restraints that are on these corporate bodies that began to basically enslave us in a more dramatic fashion. And we become enslaved to might makes right. And that's it.
Well, first I would say that, I think all anarchists, whether they're on the left or the right, they are kind of utopian and that they want their own kind of freedom or liberty or whatever. And they want a world that's peaceful and without any crime. And to the extent that that's something that to aspire to, I mean, it's not to say it's particularly possible, but it's a goal that should always be trying to be achieved. So,
when you aspire for more peace or less crime, the journey, even if you don't ever get there, the journey there is not as destructive as the journey to this libertarian utopia. Because the journey to this libertarian utopia, unless you get there, it is a completely binary situation. Because this notion where you do not have government constraining any actors in society means that you will necessarily have those who amass power and then amass even more and more power and exploit everyone else.
I do think that the way some libertarians see this journey into a libertarian utopia could be dangerous because it could allow for corporate power and it could allow for the kind of violent chaos that comes between one state and a revolution that brings about another state, because there would be a period in the time where no one is governing
will exist forever because you will never get to that utopian state. So, I mean, that's my point, is that libertarian, that's fine to have a utopian vision. And if we could just jump to that utopia, which is impossible, not just the existence of that utopia, in my estimation, because human beings were always going to organize. And that is just the nature of human beings. But the path, the journey there is actually far more oppressive and exploitative.
Okay. Well, you had a question before about how basically if you don't like it, get out. That was kind of Reagan's approach, the vote with your feet thing, where if you live in America, you at least have the opportunity to choose to move, if you can afford it, choose to move to a state whose policies you believe are less oppressive. But since it's hard for poor people who unfortunately are predisposed to committing crime due to their economic circumstances, it's harder for them to choose a government without being able to afford to move. So a way to solve that problem is to simply let the states, encourage the states to offer citizenship to people living in neighboring states. That way you can have a kind of competitive government in every state.
The same problem all over again? It's just you have 50 of those problems instead of one?
Well, to some extent, we have 50 of those problems now, but I'm not sure I'd answer that, honestly. At least no one would have any government pushed on them without their consent, and government would kind of be viewed as, or all the services provided by government would be viewed as commerce and be viewed in the context of a market, so there would be competition, and no one would have to disobey the laws based on where they live or where they're walking or where they're driving.
Why is it that much cheaper to move states as it would be to a different country? Why is it cheaper for me?
I'm sorry.
Why is it cheaper for me to move from New York to Arizona than New York to Mexico?
I'm not really talking about about whether it would be cheaper. I'm talking about how there are actually libertarian and socialist anarchy ideas that would allow people to choose who governs them regardless of where they live and without moving. If we have enough expansion of government markets into neighboring markets, into neighboring territorial jurisdictions, then people would eventually eventually be able to choose who governs them without moving and regardless of where they are.
Yeah, I'm just barely following what you're talking about. But,
okay, well, I can give you a few terms. You can look up national personal sovereignty, national personal autonomism, anarchy with a P, GORISM. Those are all right and left anarchist positions that have suggested this idea I'm talking about, and I think it could be.
Do you think any of this is possible? I mean, do you think any of this is possible? I mean, what you're talking about. I mean, do you think any of this is even remotely possible?
I do, but I don't think any of our politicians, even the most libertarian ones, would be willing to put it into place.
Okay, so do you think any of this is possible? If none of the politicians are going to put this into place, and the poor people you're talking about who can't move out of the country, don't have access to a good online access, do you think any of this is possible? Which do you think is more possible, that you and I will become multimillionaires, or that that this will happen?
I think it's equally possible that we could become rich, I think it's simply a matter of people who have had this government foisted upon them without their consent, just asserting that that rebelling against the state, even as some would call it violently, is really just self-defense. So the ability of people to see, we have to have competition to provide government services, and if people take up the slack that government has left behind, or or just take advantage of the fact that there's a market for some kind of defense agency to compete with the state, then if people could start offering their own services, whether healthcare or anything that government provides, but including self-defense and including common defense. And personal property.
But what about like Blackwater? What about Jay or whatever they call themselves now? I mean, don't we have private armies? Isn't Medicare Advantage a good example of health care provided by the private? That ended up being more expensive. I mean, look, all this is fine, but it's so fantastical that it's not even in the realm of. It's not even the realm of politics, because as we go down, like I say, I don't even know this notion that we're going to have perfect competition. It has never existed. What you're talking about has never existed in any time. There has never been a time in human history where you have two competing armies and people somehow in the middle can just decide randomly, like, I'm going to join that army or I'm going to join that army. What more often happens is one of the armies gets there first, decides that we're going to kill off, certain population. We're going to forcibly draft the others. We're going to rape the women and we're going to kill the children. That's what's happened.
I wouldn't call anything the army does voluntary action. I mean,
I'm not talking. I'm talking about private armies or non-governmental armies or whatever. I mean, look, you're living in a world that's not even like Game of Thrones is closer to reality than what you're talking about. And I'm talking throughout history. You can find, I'm sure, tiny pockets of where people are born into societies and then willingly or just are born into nature, I guess, and then willingly join societies. But they're certainly, even then, they're being coerced by the fact that they can't possibly do anything on their own that could sustain them.
Well, I'm not necessarily talking about armies, but collective self-defense agencies, which even left anarchists have proposed. But I'm also wondering how you can describe Blackwater as a private army. Isn't it funded by taxpayers? Don't they get government contracts?
Well, they get private contracts too. They work for the government is just one of their clients. Blackwater gets money from corporations too. From anybody who's got the money, they'll work for.
Okay. Well. How much less money do you think they would have if they didn't have the government contract, if it was just corporations paying them?
Okay. Significantly? Half? I don't know. They'd still exist. They'd have a smaller business. You don't think there are private entities that don't get government contracts? They get contracts from other governments. I mean, it's like, I don't know what world you're living in that any of what you're talking about can come about.
In this room, for example, there are no taxes being levied. There are no police officers. I'm living in a libertarian anarchist utopia right now. Everywhere I go where I don't encounter police or tax agents, I'm living in a libertarian utopia of my own creation.
Okay. And How did you build that? How did you create that drywall on your walls? That this device that you're using that to call me on, how did that get developed? Do you have running water where you are?
Pardon?
Do you have running water where you are?
Are you saying there would be no water without the government?
No, I'm asking if in your utopian room there, in your utopian house, do you have running water?
I do.
How did it get there?
And I have a phone, and I have things that I bought with money, and I have things that I, were it not for the Federal Reserve dollar, I would have bought it with some other currency or through bartering my labor.
Are you listening to the show on the internet?
Sorry?
Are you listening to the show on the internet?
I'm not, but I do have internet.
Okay. Isn't that tainting your libertarian utopian paradise? I mean,
no.
That's the government, dude. The government built that.
Well, the government let me survive. So, to be consistent, should I kill myself? I mean, there's no cop in the room aiming at me. So, do I?
No. Don't draw a parallel between the fact that the government built the internet and the government lets you live. That's not, those are not, that is not, that is not a parallel. That is not an analogy.
I'm saying we're
that is
not
you dealing with the fact that you're not living in a libertarian utopia in that room. You're deluding yourself. You would not be able to communicate with me in that place if it existed. You would not know that I was alive. You would not know that I had made a challenge on YouTube.
And if it were, I can play that card too, though. If it were not for private internet providers and private computer makers.
Indeed, and I am not calling for the abolition of the private internet companies. I'm not.
And I'm not calling.
But you're saying there should be no government. You're claiming that you're living in a libertarian bubble, and you're not. You're not, sir.
I make rules. I make rules voluntarily that I impose through social order, through social interaction on others.
And
I'm
you leech off the advantages you get from the government, from the tax dollars, from society, and then you. I mean, you're saying like I am floating in the middle of the sky, and you don't realize you're standing on a building.
I'm not saying that I owe none of. I'm not saying that there's nothing in my life I owe to the existence of society or voluntary association, voluntary interaction, or even government. I'm not even saying that the American government should be abolished. I'm just saying it should allow for competitors, and it should allow to.
It does have competitors. There's a lot of countries around the world.
I'm saying competitors in the same territory.
I see. All right.
Well,
all right. I mean, I don't know. I concede.
Okay.
I appreciate the call. And speaking about Ron Paul, we put up a video wherein I reported on a story that the A3P, right? This racist organization. Like, I don't know if they are neo-Nazis or I don't want to malign a full-on white supremacist organization because I know there's different flavors of white supremacy. I don't know if these guys are neo-Nazis or just plain old white supremacists, whatever they are. So my apologies if I've disparaged the organization anyway. And there was a story going around. I happened to find it at the Little Green Footballs, but all you need to do is Google it. With the Google, and you can find hundreds of links, including a link to the site Parasec. And we will put it up on the screen right now because I had a bunch of comments from apparently Ron Paul fans who were like, all you're doing is just repeating what's there. You're not proving anything. Well, I can't prove it here. I could hold up a piece of paper and say, this is a copy of the email of the story. And I know if you are on YouTube making comments, you don't know how to use Google, obviously. And people saying, that's not anonymous. That's not the real anonymous. Well, go to the site. If it makes you feel better, then fake anonymous hacked into Ron Paul, the A3P's real emails and found real connections with Ron Paul that he's met with him multiple times. And you can find online his racist emails. And then a story from the Washington Post where multiple sources have said, yeah, he knew what was in there. He did it to make money. And I should add that when you comment in YouTube and say, this stuff about Ron Paul being racist is just bullshit. It is typical. This guy who's saying this stuff looks like a big Jew. That doesn't help the credibility of your argument. And if you're trying to fight back against charges that Ron Paul has been involved with white supremacist groups, it's probably not in the best interest of the argument you're pursuing to refer to me as a big Jew, as a dirty Jew, as a kike, or it doesn't really bother me. But you understand that when you write that, and then when I link back and I look at what you've got on your YouTube thing, and it's all about the Zionist conspiracy, it undercuts your argument. So I would suggest two things for you people who do not like the fact that I am reporting simply what is true about Ron Paul. One, if you don't think it's substantiated enough by what I'm saying, just try and Google it. And two, it doesn't make you look good to refer to the fact that I'm a Jew when you're trying to argue that there's no evidence Ron Paul is a bigot. I'm not saying that Ron Paul's a bigot because you call me a Jew. It's just a... you just don't carry any real moral authority that way. Did you see Brian Kilmeade on Fox and Friends asking if two girls, if the government helped them start their lemonade stand? Oh, my God. Let's see how. Let's just see how just utterly ridiculous this is. Oh, my God. Here we go. Here is Fox and Friends interviewing two girls with a lemonade stand.
Well, somebody along the line gave you some help. Somebody helped to create this unbelievable American system that we have that allowed you to thrive. Somebody invested in roads and bridges. If you got a business, that you didn't build that. Somebody else made that happen.
Wow, well, these two girls beg to differ. They built their lemonade business.
Wait a second. First off, I don't even know how to really absorb this. First off, kudos to them for playing the entire clip. But let's go. Let's tune in and see what these two successful entrepreneurs say on this news station.
It's not only without government help, but without any help. Meet the founders of Cool Blast Lemonade, sisters 7-year-old Clara and 4-year-old Eliza Sutton. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for waking up this morning for us.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. Hey, Clara, can you explain to me what Cool Blast is? Tell me about your lemonade business.
Well, our lemonade is actually homemade, but I can't tell you our recipe because it's proprietary.
I understand.
But the investors actually signed a confidentiality agreement.
Good.
Oh, my God.
Oh. I don't even know. This is unbelievable. is unbelievable.
So we got that out of the way. I promise not to ask you about that, and I won't ask Colonel Sanders about his secret batter. But let me ask you this. Starting this business, how prideful are you? Well, who helped you start this business?
I'll tell you something. If these kids pick their nose on this, I'll send them a medal.
Our investors who are our dad and our stepmom, along with some other friends and family, including our brother.
How do you
feel? He's our employee.
Wow, your brother's, is your brother a good worker, by the way?
Yes, he is.
Good.
He's a very cute and hard worker.
Well, it's hard to imagine him cuter than you two. Clara, how do you feel about the president saying that you needed help to start this business? And just speak from within.
She's yawning.
All right, you know what? Let's switch over to... why don't you answer that one?
I would say that's rude because we worked very hard to build this business, but we did have help.
And your help came from?
Our help came from our investors, our dad and stepmom, along with other friends and family.
Right.
Yeah. Now, this is so right on so many issues, in so many ways. One, yes, this is a conversation you should be having with 4- and 5-year-olds. But I imagine, I wonder where these kids got their water. I wonder if it comes through their tap. Huh. And I wonder if their customers have horrible, horrible diarrhea. Oh, no, they don't, because the water they get from their tap is actually protected by things like the EPA. Huh.
Eliza, what's it like working with your sister and brother?
My brother does things he likes to do. And he says, car, car, every time. Every time he sees a car.
Right. This is a great setup. I mean, is there an application that I could fill out to possibly join Cool Blast Lemonade?
I don't know. That's something that you need to ask our father, though.
Right.
Oh, okay. This is just unbelievable. But I don't even know. I don't even know what else to say. Fox and Friends makes the point for us that you need to find a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old who have a lemonade stand to even begin to make the argument that people who are successful, assuming these guys are successful at their lemonade stand, you need to find a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old will be the only ones not to acknowledge that they are there because of tax expenditures and because government has supported their business in some fashion. And I imagine when these kids get older, they're going to look back on this and see it as a very horrific time in their life, being on Fox and exploited in this fashion.
I wonder if their beverages can be described as lemon wet good.
Lemon wet good, people. Cool Blast. Unbelievable.
Michael sent me a message that apparently Rush Limbaugh opened up with, none of this makes any sense.
For those of you who don't know, Random Rush is when I randomly turn on Rush Limbaugh through my app here, whatever it is, Wonder Radio, and I listen to Rush Limbaugh for 60 seconds, and I rebut him in 90 seconds. I know some of you don't like to hear from him, but sorry, folks. That's what we're going to do. And let's see if... okay, hold on. There he is. Okay, so here we go. I start now. Here it is. Random Rush.
But why don't the Marco Rubios, the Alan Wests... What a great man. What a great American. Alan West. What a great role model. Clarence Thomas. Herman Cain. None of it counts. Don't tell me the Republican Party doesn't have outreach. We do. But what are we supposed to do now? We're supposed to, in order, that mean open the borders and embrace the illegals. Is that what, no, I want you to think about this. Is that what it means? Is that what the Republican establishment, so we got to reach out to Hispanics. Is that what they mean? If we're not getting the female vote, do we become pro-choice? Do we start passing out birth control pills? Is that what we have to do? Okay, let me ask you, if that's what we have to do.
All right. Now in 90 seconds. Well, this is what I've been talking about since the opening remarks of this program today. This is why the Republican Party will never, ever, ever again, or at least until maybe my kid, my 7-year-old, is voting, win a national election. Because though you will get the Peggy Noonans, the Dick Morrises, the Britt Humes, the David Brooks, all of the Republican establishment types, all the non-Neanderthal, just money-grubbing Republican types, they may say, we've got to expand the party. We cannot overtly hate brown people. We cannot deny access to birth control to women. We cannot say that there's legitimate rape and illegitimate rape, and we can't continue to kowtow to these religious fundamentalists. They have created a Frankenstein, and Rush Limbaugh is one of the guys, the brain of the Frankenstein. There is just too much incentive on the right to let go of all that hatred, because that's how he makes his money. That's how he establishes his power, and that's how little congressmen, maybe in the South, they'll get reelected by continuing to be this crazy. So the Republican Party cannot return from where it came, from any type of moderation. It will continue this death spiral, led by its intellectual pillar, Rush Limbaugh.
The names he threw out, my God.
That was fantastic.
Herman Cain.
Herman Cain. I didn't even have a chance to get to all those. Here's our group. We have three black people. We have three black people. Three black people. Herman Cain. Is no one taking him seriously anymore? He's the one who came up with 999.
That's two more than needed to be a token.
That's right. We don't just have one black guy. We've got three black guys. What are we supposed to do now? Hand out abortion pills?
Like fund education for kids?
Yeah. No, whoa, whoa, whoa. I'm sorry. We could not have... That could not have fit into the theme of today's program any better. The Republican Party is just, they're in a death spiral.
Satan, I prepare.